Leaders are all around us, at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate, they risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Lyndon Olson. In addition to a notable career in the insurance industry, he has served in the Texas House of Representatives, chaired the State Board of Insurance, and he served as U.S. Ambassador to Sweden from 1998 to 2001. Hosting the conversation is Will May, Dean of Baylor University's School of Music. This is the second of two parts of an extended conversation between Dean May and Ambassador Olson.
Typically would define leadership, Lyndon, as getting people to do things that they either want to do or don't want to do, to achieve some sort of common goal. There's a leadership book that describes the leaders as the riders and the people that are being led as the elephants. The rider's got the reins, but if the elephant doesn't want to go where the rider pushes them, they're not going to go there, and there's nothing the rider can do. All of those, I think, are notions of how this leadership process works. But I know we, in conversation, have talked about how leadership can be used in a negative sort of way. Under that same definition. So let's start there today and talk about positive leadership and the characteristics there, and perhaps negative leadership and the characteristics, and how those two sometimes get blurred boundaries in between.
I don't think there is a definition of leadership. I think there are certain human characteristics that people tend to respond to in certain circumstances. It's not necessarily a situation ethic, but it is but it is very fluid. I use the example of I think when we are in what I would refer to as an individual singular kind of ethic, where we lead by our personal behavior, that is a kind of leadership. That is a kind of evidence or witness, or in a non-theological sense, but maybe it is in a theological sense. It is a kind of behavior where people look at our values and make judgments about how we deal with other people. I think there is a collective ethic that we see, whether it would be, for instance, during the Civil Rights era, maybe even the Vietnam War, where it was nonviolent, maybe today in the Middle East today. As we speak right now, the entire Middle East has been organized. You don't see it in the popular press today, but for the last several years, there has been soft power. That would be non-hard power like military force, but soft power has moved throughout the Middle East, and there are individuals and institutions, non-government organizations, that have been organizing non-violent protest that we are now seeing manifest themselves today. I mean, Egypt didn't just happen because everybody woke up. This has been going on for a long time, and it's been, it is a kind of leadership, a kind of soft power, a kind of nonviolent power that it worked in Egypt, for lots of reasons. But we're seeing all of that, and that's a collective behavior. If you were to say, is leadership hard power? Is it force? Is it violence? It can be. War is without great leaders in times of war and force efforts and conflicts, you'll have loss of human lives. But you have to have that kind of leadership. But there's another kind of leadership that I think that today that we saw over the years, nonviolent behavior, especially during the civil rights movements. Even though there was violence, there was Martin Luther King was essentially an apostle of Mahatma Gandhi and an apostle of Reinhold Niebuhr. Gandhi and both King were apostles of Niebuhr, and Niebuhr was an orthodox a neo-orthodox theologian back in the 30s, 40s, and especially in the early 50s. And he wrote a lot about the nature of man and violence and evil. And so I think when we talk about leadership in a collective sense, sometimes today we lose our personal principle. We don't see in our political life today, I think we say things about other people, do things towards other people, and we feel like we're not responsible for what we say or what we do. Mm-hmm. By that, I mean the raging rhetoric in our culture today. Yeah. On the left and on the right, it seems a little louder on the right, probably because the right would say, well, that's because everybody on the left is in the media. Well, I'm not sure. Yeah, there are probably lots of people on the left in the media because last time I checked, a whole bunch of folks in business school weren't going to into communications, you know.
Right.
And so that doesn't bother me. I try to take that into consideration. But today it's almost as though we say anything, do anything, try to compel forced behavior both from the left and the right without any consideration of any kind of collegiality, consensus building, or value building, and it's unhealthy.
Is this being acted out of our sight in the corporate world?
I think that when people say to me in public life anyway, that I want my government run like a business, I try to hear what they're really saying because I don't know if you can run a government like a business because of the structure of governance that decides how authority is exercised. It's not that difficult to run a private corporation or a business because if you're in charge and you have the authority and you have the ability to make decisions about people's lives, hiring, firing, benefits, salary, compensation, bonus, marketing decisions, you pretty well can control the behavior of that institution. The larger it gets, the more difficult it is, but you've delegated that authority down the line. In the public sector, the difference is, and when people say, I want my government run like a business, I reflect back on the fact that I want it run efficiently. Adolf Hitler wanted government to run efficiently,
right,
too. So I'm not real sure how efficient I want the government. I want it efficient, of course. I want it to be balanced, of course. I want it to be responsible, of course. And so you then have to define what does that mean. I think what I hear people say is that they don't want wasteful spending. They want administrative easiness. They're tired of infringement on their freedoms. But I don't know that you can run a government like you run a business because the nature of government is so diffused. I mean, you've got 430 some odd House members, you've got 100 senators, each one has a constituency, they respond to the constituencies. The member of the Congress or the House or Senate, member of the legislature, city council, school board, they always are constantly asking themselves the eternal question, do I represent my constituency or my conscience? And it goes back to Plato. It goes back to the Greeks. It's the classic old political philosophical question in a representative government. Who do I represent?
That's right. But in those, if you read books on leadership, and there are books aplenty, on leadership, and for the most part, with all due respect to the authors of those books, you can read the preface and kind of get the idea, and you don't need to read the rest of the book. But if we look at all those references on how to be a leader, there's always a discussion of certain particular traits. A person is trustworthy. A person is honest. A person communicates well. A person leads by example. A person has an empathy for the person that they're trying to lead. And we can go on with that litany. When I look at leadership in our government today, I have a hard time finding some of those traits of trustworthiness and honesty and square shooting and those kinds of things that we recognize as valuable. because they seem to be always governed by imagery and who's going to get themselves reelected and all of those characteristics. What happened? Are those traits hidden, or are they just not there?
I think they're there. I think we've lost touch. And by we, I'm talking about the electorate. I think we've lost touch with our elected officials. There was a day in my lifetime, in your lifetime, in my electoral life, in my political electoral life, where I would come to back home to McLennan County, and I would go to every community in McLennan County, every school board, every Rotary Club, every domino parlor, every Masonic temple, every church, every barbecue, every pig sticking, everything. And I would, and I'd touch people, and I'd touch them and shake their hands, and they would eat me out. And I'd sit there in a drugstore in Lothar Krause's store in McGregor, and I'd have 10 people eating me out about the way I voted. And I'd sit there and I'd answer the questions under the Grand Inquisition for an hour, and they'd buy me a Dr. Pepper, and I'd take it. And I would, and then they'd smell me and look at me, and they'd tell me my hair was too long, or they could feel me and touch me.
Right.
They knew who I was. They knew a lot about me. They expected me to come back. That day's gone in America. Today, the consultants are greatly in control. The people that are running today, so many of them, if you set them down and said, let's talk about governance, or more especially, put them in a conference committee where the House has gone through this, the bill's gone through the House and the Senate, both in the Congress and in Austin or wherever it may be, and say, you work this out. Well, they'd have to go check with somebody because they may not. There are so many ideologues today on the left and the right. There's no balance. There's no consensus. There's no wanting to work with each other. When in my public life, we'd just kill each other on the floor of the House, maybe in the floor of the Senate. And then at night, we'd go have a hamburger or a glass of wine or a Dr. Pepper, and we'd talk to each other. We'd find out how each other's kids were, families were. What made them happy? What made them sad? You know, would they like to go fishing with us? Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans, that day today is basically gone, and we're not better for it.
Is that the core, then, do you think, of why there seems to be such a rebellion now among the American public that led to and groups like the Tea Party and others that have just said, you know, enough is enough. And
yeah,
and
I think they feel, I mean, I'm speaking out of the Tea Party. I'm speaking to people that I know that are in the Tea Party. I wouldn't agree with the language of the Tea Party. I think it's very strident. I think it's very angry, it seems like. But I know a lot of the members locally in the Tea Party. And I know them, I've known them for 50 years, many of them. And I got to tell you, they are good. They're good people, and there is an authenticity that I think we are all starving for in this country. We are starving to know why things are happening to us. There's so much change, whether it's globalization, whether it's this medium of radio or television or movies or the internet. The world's going so fast, and people don't believe anybody anymore. And money, I mean, when you're talking about, we've now, the Supreme Court through the Citizens United case, we have now opened the floodgates. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have done that. That may have been an appropriate ruling as to free speech. But we've opened the floodgates to millions and millions and millions of dollars that where you'll have consultants going out creating ads where people can't respond through the media because it costs money. And I think a lot of the Tea Party, I mean, you can say, well, there's this in it and that in it. But I do think there is an element within the Tea Party that seeks authenticity and that is something we all want. And we're all in conflict. This is one of the first times in my adult life where the Democratic Party, I came out of the moderate conservative wing of my party. We were always fighting liberals, you know. Liberals were always fighting us. All of a sudden, you know, then there was the Republican Party, and now there's a hard right that the Republicans are fighting. We're all fighting. And it's just fundamentally unhealthy. At least the Democrats, we'd fight each other in the primary and say, okay, now we got to work out our differences in December. And we did it. But the Republican Party doesn't have a history of that yet. I think they'll probably eventually get there with the Tea Party movement.
There's a favorite Abraham Lincoln quote of mine that I think speaks to this in a way, and that's, quoting Lincoln, "Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power."
Yeah. I hadn't heard that before. It's powerful. I've seen power in a lot of different venues, legislative power, wealth, economic power, power of money in Wall Street, power, political power. That's to me, power, there's nothing wrong with power. It can be social power. It can be one's physical beauty, prowess, strength. It can be one's intellect, be a great singer. It could be a great politician. There's nothing wrong with power. As long as that power is not used to abuse other people. You say, well, what does that mean? Well, we're now defining all of that. But I think if we ask ourselves, what is the responsible way to execute our power? Mm-hmm. Now, the right today would say the left has executed it wrongly. So that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm.
It would seem that brings us back to the whole notion of leadership. There's leadership that would use the power of leadership to compel someone to believe as I believe or do as I demand. And then there's leadership that would use that power to have people experience personal growth and fulfillment. And I see both of those kinds of approaches to leadership acted out in our culture, I think, on a daily basis.
I agree with you. I think if more people in public in power today in our government, and it may be that could be within our in the private sector as well. In the private sector does some things very well, and that is it responds to the markets, it responds to the positiveness of the markets. I mean, there may be some that bet short and all that kind of stuff, but it responds to the truth of the markets, and I think in our public, in our civic life today, one of the things that we're not getting are the benefits of I'm a Democrat, I'm a moderate Democrat, I'm pro business. And I have always thought I was moderate in social issues, but I guess today I haven't changed my views in my lifetime, but today it sounds like I'm more than not moderate anymore, probably a little bit to the left of that, but I think I'm moderate in my social views and my social behavior. But today, people don't want you to, they don't want that. They want you to be, you're either for them or against them, you're either evil or you're patriotic, or you're either, if you're on the left and are on the right, and you're calling everybody on the left airheads, and you're on the left, you call everybody on the right greedy and not loving. No, that's true. Yeah. Where are the Bill Buckleys of today? I read George Will. I don't always agree with him, but I like George Will. I intellectually respect George Will. I want voices different than mine. I want to read voices on the left. I may not agree with them, but I want to know what they're thinking. And today, I don't think we're doing that. I mean, I just think we say, this is the way it is, that's it, I don't want to hear anything else, and I'm going to run over you because I can. And, there was a time where Democrats probably, at least those on the left, may have thought the same thing. But I think we're not better off because of that stridence.
I agree. We're speaking with Lyndon Olson on KWBU Radio and our Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Will May. dean of the music school at Baylor, and you might be wondering why a dean of a music school is talking politics with Lennon Olson. Lennon and I go back to our days in Ewell Porter's choir together back as undergraduates, and we're pleased to have him in the studio today. Let's talk about your time as ambassador, because it seems to me that that's a different sort of leadership. At least my image of an ambassador is one who is out there friend-raising, if you will, and acting as a representative of the American government. During the Clinton administration, Lennon served as an ambassador to Sweden, as many of you know, and there's a long and distinguished title that goes along with that that you'll have to share with the audience, because I can't remember it nor pronounce part of the words, but your official title was?
I was the United States Ambassador Extraordinary and Plenipotentiary to the Kingdom of Sweden, and the first time that the King of Sweden addressed me was Your Excellency. And I thought, you know, when I go back to Waco or Valley Mills, Texas, and I tell the boys at the Dairy Queen that they call me Your Excellency, they're probably going to think I have a sexual preference, you know.
But that, and you have the reputation in this community of taking Uncle Dan's barbecue.
Yeah.
To Sweden and share it with the unwashed in
The Swedes loved Dan. Dan came over several times, and the Swedes went nuts over him. He cut the king's brother-in-law's towel off with a greasy hand in the middle of a barbecue. Dan was just the Irish ambassador. Absolutely fell in love with him at an Irish day pub. It was fascinating.
Somewhere in there is our leadership traits.
Well, actually, they are. You know, again, it goes back to the conversation about relations.
Yes.
You know, it's relational. The United States does not live in a world where we cannot have a healthy relationship with the rest of the world. The ambassadorship was a whole different conversation about leadership, because it has leadership at so many different levels. One, to get the appointment was a fiercely competitive, controversial challenge.
Yeah.
Once you get it, you've got to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. You've got to go through senatorial hearings and kind of examinations and cross-examinations. You've got to be cleared by the CIA and the FBI. You've got to disclose everything you've ever done in your life, every check you've ever cashed, every pharmaceutical prescription you've ever received. They went back to my first, second grade, all the teachers that were alive, doctors. There were 90 some odd people, I think I was told at one time, that were interviewed before you could even get the nomination from the president. So it was, and then once you receive the nomination from the president, there was a whole world attendant to that. And then you realize that you are informed that no one in the nation of Sweden, other than the president, when you're in Sweden, that no one outranks you other than the president of the United States, five-star generals, Congress. And it's a very intellectually and practically a fascinating position to hold. This country is so magnificent to represent. I was so proud. And when I left the ambassadorship, somebody asked me, they said, Lyndon, if there was one thing that you could say that made America great, what would it be? And I thought for a while, and I thought, you know, and I thought a long time about it, actually. And I said to the Swedes, I said, I think it's our differences. And the Swedes are mostly blonde, blue-eyed Lutheran, except right. for this great. There's now been a big growth in the Muslim community from Bosnia. They took about three times as many refugees per capita as anybody in the world that were a Muslim. And I think as difficult as our differences are, whether it's race, religion, national origin, heritage, whatever it is. This country is the first one in the world that's dealt with all of this, and it makes you proud. You, just to sit back and say, how in the world have we done this in America? We did it because we had leadership.
Yes.
We did it because at times in our history, we had, there may have been people who were leading us that we personally might not have liked. Then there may have been people who led us because we respected their points of view. But it's amazing how this country has survived, and we're going to survive going forward. We have to adjust and change, and we have to understand other cultures and understand other religions, and we don't have to adopt those. I'm a Presbyterian. I live in Waco, Texas. I've been a Democrat. Well, you know what a Presbyterian was 50 years ago, and Waco was 50 years ago, and a Democrat 50 years ago is different today. I have to adjust all of those things, and I have to decide where my lines are going to be, and we're all going through a lot of change, and we need people who are introspective and thoughtful and self-critical and analytical that we trust and have confidence in order for us to continue to be a rich, growing civilization.
So if there's a young person out there in the sound of your voice and you are going to give them your best advice because they might have ambitions of serving in that role that you just described and carrying the weight of our future on their shoulders, if you will. And we need some broad-shouldered young people to step up, I think, in our culture today. What would you tell them? What advice would you give them?
First piece of advice would be education, education, education. Now, what if they didn't get an education? You can still do it, but it's going to be a lot harder. Yeah. And be kind to people that you don't like. Be self-critical. Don't get down on yourself. Listen to other people. Listen to points of view that you don't agree with. Try to respect them. Laugh a lot. Enjoy good jokes. And understand that there's sometimes that your heart and your head are not going to be the same, and try to figure that out. And get as much education as you can get, because going forward, the Chinese, the Indians, we are in a world where we as America are in the process of beginning to have to adjust who we are in the world. And when you realize that 75% of the graduate schools in the hard sciences in the United States are made up of foreign students, that should tell you a whole lot about what's going on. Did you know that major multinational corporations that couldn't get in the borders of the United States after the Iraqi conflict, because it took them so long to get in, they have started going to multinational companies in the United States, and we are building universities in India and China. And the people that were coming to America, their intellectual property, their ideas, the things that we built the entire telecom and dot-com boom on, those people are going home now and staying home, and we are building, we being business, markets. Markets don't care if those brains are in the United States, India, or China. They're going to go where they are. And those brains that have gone home that we wouldn't let in because we were so fearful. I'd also say the old doctrine, you don't have anything to fear but fear itself, Roosevelt.
Right.
That quote from Roosevelt was one that should be appropriate today. Americans have been fearful for years now. We need to be realistic. We need to be determined. We need to be direct in our dealings with people. We don't need to be weak. We need to be strong. But we do not need to be frightened every time something negative happens. That's not who we are as a people. And we are going to be competing in a world that we have not had to compete in before. And there are going to be resources that we've not had to compete against. And there's going to be intellectual property that has left us that we have taken advantage of over the years that's going back home. And we need to adjust all those things.
It's been a delight, Lyndon.
Thank you, Will. It's been a joy.
You've been listening to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. This and past episodes are archived online at kwbu.org.